Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Returning to the form in which he began, Sam Lipsight, author of the New York Times bestseller The Ask, offers up The Fun Parts, a book of bold, hilarious, and deeply felt collection of stories. A boy eats his way to self-discovery while another must battle the reality-brandishing monster preying on his fantasy realm. Meanwhile, an aerobics instructor, the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, makes the most shocking leap imaginable to save her soul. Just a few of the stories, some first published in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, and Playboy. Sam Lipsight is the author of Venus Drive, The Subject Steve, Homeland, and The Ask. He teaches writing at Columbia University's School of Arts, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited about this because I've been a fan of your work, and for whatever reason, I have not been able to set this up in the past. So when this book came out, I thought, well, this is great because I get to talk about stories. You've been doing novels, and then I get to talk about stories because that's how I was first introduced to you.
Right.
Was it always your for the next project to consciously put together a collection, or is this a collection in the truest sense where things that you've written over the years that you wanted to put together?
Well, it was a little of both because I've been writing stories as I was writing some of the novels or between them, alongside them, and publishing them here and there. And I had a few, and I began to think about doing another collection. And then when I really decided to do that, I cleared the table for a few years and just concentrated on writing short stories.
What is the power of the short story for you as a writer?
Well, I love the challenge of trying to do something in a limited amount of space. Nathaniel West once said, he wrote very short novels, but he once said, you know, you only have time to explode. And I think about that with a short story as well. And it doesn't have to be big pyrotechnics, but you're really kind of reaching for a single momentous effect at some point, usually at the end. It's kind of more like writing a poem in some ways. You really have to manage every word, every sentence. I try to do that in novels too. I think we all do, but in a short story, it's really paramount that everything is in the right place.
Do you know that moment, that crescendo at the end, is that what you start with, or do you still have to get there?
I have to get there, and when I write a first draft, I'm really just trying to figure out what it is I'm writing. People say it starts talking to you, and I have found that to be true. So you're writing along, and you don't know where it's going to lead you, but you know what's behind you, and you kind of have a shape that's taking form in front of you. But you land at a certain point, and sometimes you're lucky enough to recognize that that's where you were supposed to land, and that's the natural place for the story to end. Sometimes you don't recognize it right away. You shoot past it, but then you have to come back. Mm. Or you took a wrong fork, and you kind of double back a little bit and then take the other direction, usually a harder direction, and you get there.
And
if the story is successful. I have a lot of failures, you know, stacked up at home.
How do you qualify that in the sense of what makes something a failure to a success as far as you're concerned?
Well, to me, it's something that I try not to publish the failures. But the stories that they were beginnings that I didn't figure out. They never really led to anything interesting, and they didn't land anywhere that was striking. And they just kind of fizzled.
When you get something that works and doesn't fizzle, and it starts to go, is there that moment where you say, I could perhaps put this aside and this could be something larger, this could be a novel, or this has to be a story?
I can usually tell. In the first writing, the first 5 pages or 10 pages of anything, I'm not exactly sure, but I begin to see fairly quickly whether the thing is kind of opening up in a really expansive way that would allow more stories, more characters, a bigger world, or if it's sort of taking on the contours of something shorter and needs to be kind of contained and compressed to work. usually I'm writing and figuring and finding out what the thing isn't. You know, okay, this isn't about space travel. This isn't about cowboys. This isn't about, you know, with each sentence, you're kind of eliminating a lot of possibilities too. And so then you begin, I begin to get a sense of how long this thing will sustain itself as well.
There is a sense of obviously humor and outrageousness to some of what you write. Is that difficult to hone and to work on and to revise without losing that quality?
Well, I guess I have to be a little careful, but a lot of the work that I do that I think is really useful is revision. The first draft is I'm just trying to get this lump of clay on the table. And so I don't even like writing. I like rewriting. I like revising. And I, people talk about the danger of doing too much of that, but I think that, you know, you can really fine-tune things a great deal by sticking with them and putting them aside and then looking at them again and letting time do some editing and letting yourself do some editing. Some of these things work on an intricate level, and it takes a while. It takes drafts to really get that working.
So how much of the process is thinking, is figuring out what that lump of clay is going to be and ultimately what it can become?
Well, I find that thinking apart from writing doesn't do me that much good. It does towards the end of something when I'm really trying to figure out some kind of micro level issues. But really, my best thinking happens when I'm writing and not thinking so much and just sort of letting the story and letting the language guide me. And then I start to say things I didn't think I was capable of saying, and I start to arrive at scenes and moments that I hadn't thought of before. I really find that the best thinking happens through composition rather than planning something beforehand. But that's how I work. Other people can have it all in their head and then execute it.
I've heard writers describe that feeling, though, of being able to write something that they didn't think that they were capable of writing. That seems to me as it would be a magical moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of the reasons you do it.
And do you know what ingredients are there when you look back at it and say, okay, that's it?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with coming to something that, to use that old phrase, that's surprising but inevitable. That's, you know, not what you expected, but seems exactly right now that you've written it. That speaks to something you didn't know you wanted to speak to. That speaks of an emotional truth you didn't know you were really reckoning with.
When you look at the stories in this book, you don't think of a theme at all. Obviously, they're all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, the theme is, I mean, I say it's a linked collection and it's linked by the fact that I wrote them all.
Right, right. But the link is you.
Right.
And that, so although they have very different voices, though, which is so interesting.
Well, I think if you write a lot, you begin to realize they're all you in some way, but they're also outside of you. And there's this swirl that's going through you all the time of everything you've thought and felt and read and heard about and overheard and misheard and stories people have told you and things you've witnessed. And just it's a big swirl. And from that, there's a lot of stuff that might not sound like you, but is part of you, is part of what's been coursing through you for a long time.
When you look at at individual stories that are in this collection, is there something that you can point to, a story perhaps that you point to and say, this is some of my finest work? Or don't you look at it that way?
I don't pick, because I think that they all have aspects of my finest work. And, you know, I'm not going to get sentimental about it. And it's not like choosing a favorite child. as some yeah. authors would say. But
I've heard that a lot.
They also represent different moments in the last few years and different things I've been trying. What's excited me a lot are some of the newer stories, if only because, you know, they're fresher for me and represent work I've been doing lately. And so stories like The Climber Room and Deniers and Disappointment Occurs in the Past, The Dungeon Master, those are more recent stories, and they're kind of unlike some of the things I've written in the past. And a couple of those stories have female protagonists, which I, you know, hadn't done. I'd done that but not published pieces with female protagonists before, and I felt happy about how those stories worked out, and they all are special to me in different ways.
The narrative voices that come through in this book are so much fun and fascinating. And I'll use one as an example in The Republic of Empathy. Tell us a little bit about that voice, how it was chosen, and what ultimately you wanted to achieve.
Well, there are a couple of voices kind of revolving in that story. Yeah. So I started with this character, William, who has a kind of slipstream moment at the end, I guess, where he's not sure what year he's in, but sort of a suburban dad. But then we move to a young sort of edgier voice, and it's the voice of a young adult narrator who's very aware that he's a young adult narrator in a young adult novel, and he's trying to break out of that novel. But some of these characters are beginning to overlap. So, and then we have a banker who's made a lot of money and now wants to explore questions of authenticity in the art world. And finally, one of the voices that I felt was kind of a crazy choice at the time, but I'm happy the way it worked out, was the voice of a drone, a female drone. predator type plane. And I think at one point I thought, oh, you know, you could do a whole novel in the voice of a drone, but I wanted to test it out really as part of a story. So that was Drone Sister Reaper, and I think I had a lot of fun with that.
Sam Lipsight is the author of the new collection of stories, The Fun Parts. It is published by FSG. There always seems to be kind of that violent. There's that meltdown. Things sort of collapse.
It might be kind of sometimes it's an implosion. It's an inward collapse, and sometimes it takes place in the external world, and there's a little violence. But yeah, there's always something going wrong.
And sometimes it can be vague, and sometimes it can be very.
Explicit. Sure.
Explicit. And that is, do you see yourself ever writing something different than that? Or is that you?
Well, I think that I've had a lot of quiet moments in some of my other books. Mm. But I think that we kind of are sometimes caught in this idea that, oh, nothing, you know, you shouldn't write some kind of big moment or violent moment or crisis moment, because that's not really what life is, you know, like. But it is what it's like, and there's a lot of stuff going on around us, and in the sense of our own turmoil. And so, I feel that it's important to face up to some of that stuff, and not just pretend everything is represented by staying with the quiet desperation at all times. Sometimes the desperation's not that quiet.
I don't know why. I just thought of like a question to ask you, but it seems odd, but I'm going to ask you anyway. And that is, once you get that out, does your sleep pattern change at all, in the sense of if you've been dealing with something that is violent or something that is that has a turmoil to it? Is that different? Is that cathartic in getting that out as opposed to having it sort of raging inside of you?
Well, I don't know that it's always raging inside of me and I need to get it out. Sometimes it is, but catharsis is a byproduct of I think what I'm trying to do, which is create thought and feeling in other people, You know, I'm doing this, creating these effects for other people to enjoy or to engage with readers. And so I don't do it to get something out. If I feel relieved in some instances, that's great. But yeah, there's probably some element of unburdening that happens just from writing. I think when I'm not writing, I get very antsy and I get a little, I get jumpy, a little angry. And when I'm writing, no matter really, the content doesn't really matter. It's more, am I in the process of creating characters and writing these stories or novels? A certain serenity enters my life.
A calmness within that communication.
Because I know that it's not even that I'm communicating, it's that I'm making. And
creating.
Yeah, I'm inside of a world that I'm making. And so I don't have to be disappointed by the real one.
One of the wildest stories in the book is The Wisdom of the Doulas. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Well, after my wife had our first child, she became very interested in the birth process, and she studied very hard and became a childbirth educator, and she's a sometime doula, and she's written books on childbirth and early newborn care, and she's a real expert in that field. And so sitting around, I absorbed a lot of stuff. And then one day it occurred to me, you know, it'd be fun to think of a character who was the worst person for the job. So in terms of being a doula, in terms of being in charge of taking care of a woman after she's given birth, and or even while she's given birth, there are kind of different kinds of doulas depending on the situation. But somebody who is not patient, who is not that giving, who is filled with anxiety, and so the character of Mitch was born. And I was, you know, able to use a lot of the stuff I'd sort of gleaned from my wife and her research and teaching for that story.
And the Gottwald family basically has to be persuaded to take on this guy.
Yeah, well, he comes highly recommended, but it turns out that, you know, here's a spoiler alert, but it turns out that he forged the letter of recommendation.
Yeah, because all goes well for about a paragraph.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's not that he doesn't know what he's doing. It's that he doesn't know. It's his bedside manner, really. That's kind of a problem.
There is the joke writing in it, right? I mean, there is sort of a 1-2 punch.
Element of comedy. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important.
And is that a challenge to write in the context of something larger, even if it's a short story or in a novel?
No, it's all mixed together for me. It's sort of my filter. It's how the world comes through me and how language comes through me. And sometimes, or usually, it's some collision of the tragic and the comic. Or maybe the phrase serio comic helps. But I always see things as incredibly sad and incredibly funny at the same time. And so I'm interested in how these things thread together in a way that gets to real feeling on the page, you know, that isn't just a downer and that isn't just jokes, but is a kind of gets to the texture of life.
You spoke about the rewriting process a few moments ago, but in the creation of that, the wonderful dialogue that we read, to get the timing of that so wonderful, I would assume that does have to be pored over and worked on.
Absolutely. It's sort of there's a lot of revision in the dialogue, and because it's about timing and it's about. And I never want the dialogue to be sort of set apart from the other sections or the other elements of the narrative as though we'll just get through this. These are just people saying yeah and okay to each other, and then we'll get back to the really important writing. I feel the dialogue needs to be as shaped and as charged as the description.
Mm. When you
and the action. Yeah.
Yeah, the action.
Yeah.
Which often comes very, very quickly.
Sometimes. And then there are, you know, immediate turns, I hope. So.
And are you constantly thinking of the turns, or the turns just happen?
Well, in the beginning, I sort of turn blindly, or I take the turns that – and then in revision, I begin to see, well, I don't need to go there. I should go there. I missed one here. This was a great opportunity to take it – to link that to this and to get – you know, to get this thing that I want to happen sooner, or whatever it is. You know, you begin to see a better route as you revise.
When you think of your progression as a writer and your confidence, and even in the process of teaching at Columbia, what wisdom do you think that you have? That you have gained that you like to impart upon students?
Well, I'm wary of universal nuggets of writing advice, because I find working with these very talented people that it's case by case. It has to do with what each person is working on, and I try to engage with their writing based on what their goals are and what, you know. So I'm not trying to get them to write like I write. So I'm trying to figure out the best way I can help them do what they're trying to do. And so what, I could say to one, write what you know, and say to the other, write what you don't know. And those things, you know, fit where they are and what they're up against in their work. So I would never, I don't even believe that there are these general platitudes that really can benefit everybody. You know, show don't tell is a big creative writing dictum, and I think that some of the best things I've read are all telling, and some are all showing. And what are you doing? What are you trying to do? What are you trying to pull off here? Because you can, as long as you can pull it off, you can do anything and break any rule.
Was there a person for you that helped in the process early on?
Yeah, well, at a certain point, I studied with the editor, writer, and teacher Gordon Lish, and I was in my early 20s, and it was and had no real writing ego, and it was a really kind of great time to go in there and just first of all, kind of strip myself of a lot of tics I had and a lot of tricks that, you know, had gotten me through up till then, to the point where people could pat me on the head and say, you know, you're good. You're good for your age, or you're a good high school writer. and then suddenly I wasn't in high school anymore. And, I was in my early 20s, and I really hadn't progressed. And so really studying with somebody who was so passionate and so giving of his time and his ear, which was an amazing ear, really, really was a big influence.
The Ask was such a wonderful novel and was so well received. Were you proud of that and how it went out into the world?
Yes. I mean, I'd had a really kind of up and down publishing career because, I'd gone through a lot of rejection at different times,
right.
and then acceptance in other countries, and then acceptance here. And so The Ask, I was just thrilled with the way that it sort of got taken up by people and really looked at and reviewed and taken seriously. I was very pleased with the reception to The Ask.
The new book is The Fun Parts, Stories. It is published by FSG. Sam Lipsight, I want to thank you very much for being with us. A real pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. The show is recorded at the Radio Foundation in New York City. My thanks to their team. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.